This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer. Live your best life
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
You're listening to Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast. I'm Poonam Verma. Today, we're talking to Dr. Simone about inflammation, hormonal imbalance, and building up your immunity. We're also talking about leaky gut syndrome. And did you know that the gut is known as the second brain? Also, emergencies and accidents. Is it really what George Clooney represented in E&R? And how kind are you to yourself? We're talking self-compassion with psychologist Mumta Saha, and we'll be talking wellness retreats. If you want to get away, make sure you stay tuned.
Healthy Habits
on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
So we're now talking to a doctor who is a doctor to many celebrities. Her name is Dr. Simone Labouche. She's a PhD and founder of Rejuve Wellness and a nutritionist to many celebrities, including supermodels Elle Macpherson, Miranda Kerr, also reality TV stars like Kylie Jenner, Kris Jenner, Kourtney Jenner. I can say many, many more, but I'll let her explain them. Now, she's going to talk to us about inflammation, hormonal imbalances, and building up your immunity, which is very crucial at this time, because especially during COVID, I know a lot of people were struggling and trying to find out how to build up your immunity. Welcome, Dr. Simone. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm great. So let's get down to the basics. As a doctor for so many celebrities, who is the most hormonal one? I know you can't tell
me. I don't know whether you can say the most hormonal one, but my gorgeous client, Zara Phillips, I just helped her have a gorgeous baby boy. Oh. So not so much hormonal, but fertile.
Oh, okay, fertile.
Now that we've helped her push through for baby number three.
How do you have so many celebrity guests? You must be really good.
We don't advertise. We just treat people. We're, you know, at Rejuve Wellness, we've been on Harley Street in London since 1998, and now we're here in the UAE. And we just stay patient focused. And I think if you focus on making people well, they tell their friends, and then people come because they get results. So I think if you stay patient focused and people get well, it works.
So let's talk first about inflammation. I've struggled with this in my ankle. So I know it's basically your body's response to things that harm it, but how does it actually manifest physically?
So we have two different forms of inflammation. The acute, when you have an injury, which is a great healing mechanism of the body. The chronic inflammation is what I see in my clinic and patients all over the world these days on, used to be Skype, now it's Zoom, is because from various different lifestyle habits, so whether it's too much red meat and dairy, sugar, it could be thoughts, toxic thoughts, feeling depression, anxious, and toxic thinking. I'm actually doing another master's degree in neuroscience at the moment because I'm so excited by that connection between the gut brain and the heart brain. So chronic inflammation is what we always see is the root cause of disease. So it's not the same as you having a sore ankle because you've had an injury, but it is the same if you have a sore ankle or joints, but you haven't had an injury. So the whole body becomes inflamed based on your lifestyle choices, what you think about and what you do.
You know what? That's quite interesting because when I had that ankle, I didn't do anything. I just remember I was skiing and that was the only thing I did. But somebody later, they were doing some healing on me and they said, that's where you keep your stress.
Exactly. So that means you're feeling it in the acute area. You feel it localized in the ankle. But it's come about from years of systemic buildup of a toxic load. And whether that is, as I said, I've got a new phrase I'm working on the moment with one of my mentors, psychoneuroinflammation. We know for the immune system. Mm-hmm. So we know that what we think about affects the immune system. But I'm doing lots of research now in this master's of how what we think about directly affects your inflammatory markers as well.
Oh, wow.
Because it either leaves you in fight or flight.
Yes, I've had that.
Stress mode.
Yeah.
Or in healing. We want you to be in parasympathetic mode to heal, not in sympathetic mode, which is fight or flight. Oh, unless, you know, you do have a tiger running towards you and you have to get out of the way. But most of us have stressful thoughts, email or someone, a colleague or a family member or what have you, triggering us, or our own thoughts maybe of, you know, not feeling worthy, or, you know, our own internal critic, which can also cause us to be in stress, and it shuts the body down, increased heart rate, increased cortisol, here comes obesity, down go your hormones. It's all one big story.
Oh, my. The human body is really confusing, Dr. Simone. It's everything is so connected. And I know that stress causes so many things in the body that we don't even put it down to, and we think it's something else. So let me ask you a question. So, for example, when I sprain my ankle, that's the only inflammation that I know that I've experienced on a physical level. I had two doctors say to me, you need an operation, and I said no. Then I went to my homeopath, and it actually reduced in a week. But what I've noticed is there is always a little bit of a weakness on that side. Is that because I'm still holding on to stress?
It could be a combination of things. I feel that the you know, you can't cut your head off and just presume it's a physical thing and vice versa. Mm. We are mind and body. It's just the way we're made as humans. So I feel that it would be worthwhile, if you're slow to healing, there'd be something symptomatic, something, you know, inherently going on. You're made up of 50 trillion cells. So I feel there would be some sort of toxic load which is slowing down the physical healing.
Yeah.
And there's always an emotional route to disease. Even 5 years ago when I had a breast cancer lump, you know, I did my protocol, 100 days it left, but I would have been open to doing other system. I've got a PhD in cancer, so I could afford to do that. But meaning that whatever it is, whether I'm working with my fertility patients, whether it's chronic pain, whether it's IBS, whether it's depression, anxiety, whether it's hormonal or cancer, whatever is the root, it might be different fruit with different symptoms in your life and in your case, but there'll always be a physical and emotional component to whatever you're facing.
No, I agree. I was just literally saying to my producer, Zeno, we were talking about some stuff that she had been struggling with health-wise recently, and I said, from what I know, your emotions affect different organs in your body. And is that correct?
Yeah, in Chinese and Ayurvedic medicine, we always refer to the organ having an emotion. So the liver, often if you're angry, they'll be trapped emotions and toxins in the liver. So liver, it'll be anger, kidney, it'll be fear, lung, it'll be grief. Most organs have an emotion associated with that, and that's why we need to keep, you know, you're made up of 11 systems and 50 trillion cells. So I know it's complicated, but if you really think about it, that's why when I treat a patient holistically, we always talk about the 7 pillars of wellness. So if you get your sleep right and your nutrition and you move your body and you look at your environmental toxic load, you use some form of supplementation. Unfortunately, the world is not like it was when our grandparents were little. You know, it's more toxic food, you know, and over farming, soils don't rest every 7 years. So in some form of supplementation and mindfulness, we've got to get your head in the game. We've got to calm the nervous system down, keep on calming that into the parasympathetic. And then I know it's complicated, but if you simplify it like that, it's kind of manageable. Oh, I can do things every day to support those 7 systems. And then you're in flow and you'll feel that your life is so much easier.
Healthy Habits
on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
So, Dr. Simone, let me ask you a question. What are some of the worst symptoms you've seen when a body's been inflamed? How serious can it get, inflammation in the body?
Well, it goes right down to heart disease, stroke, cancer, Alzheimer's. I mean, it goes right into diabetes. It goes into chronic serious illness and imbalances.
Yeah.
And then it can start quite mild. So you might just be feeling, I said, you haven't done anything in particular, but you can just feel, gosh, I'm not quite sure why I feel a bit kind of stiff or in pain. You might actually feel it in your gut and your digestive system. It can also have a knock-on effect. As I said, definitely always that gut-brain connection with depression and anxiety. So it can be something quite mild, just feeling a bit out of sorts. You feel exhausted. You're not sleeping well. You can get those lows in the afternoon, the circadian rhythms, and wanting to crave and eat lots of chocolate. And junk food cravings is also a big trigger as well.
Oh,
that's
really?
The kind of the beginning of the story. And then it would normally take, you know, a decade or so for something serious and chronic to manifest, like diabetes or cancer or heart disease.
So have you noticed it gone up since COVID hit with people's health?
Yeah, gosh, I've been calling it kind of like the COVID cave. I actually went into the cave myself, you know, going from work and traveling back to the UK in our clinic once a month, and then switching, no more travel, and homeschooling three children, even myself, because with the stress of the change, I was kind of defaulting to bread and cheese and things that I haven't eaten for years. So a lot of people from the level of stress will be in fear and anxious, of course, and that as a result, the body doesn't understand. It's just something external. It feels there's a truck coming or a tiger coming, so we go into inflammatory mode. And people are, you know, like I did this time back to last February, I sorted myself out. I called myself into my office, did my urine test and sorted myself out. But I've just seen a lot of people, of course, using food as a comfort because it's we're in unprecedented times. And normally comfort foods are the high inflammatory, which will be the burgers and the junk and the, you know, the fatty foods and the sugars and the ice cream. So that's from that stress response and comfort eating and the emotional stress response, the mind-body has become significantly out of balance. And, yeah, inflammation is skyrocketing.
Yeah, no, I
know. Even for the children, even for the kids.
I know a lot of people who comfort eat and quite overeat, actually. It's quite scary when I see it. So I've had two questions from Mona. The first one is, I've been told that I have fatty liver at level 2. How do I treat this as naturally as possible?
Okay, so step number one, what you need to be doing is eating more plants, less animals. I'm not vegan. I don't do anything extreme. I used to have severe eating disorders in my 20s and anorexia, bulimia, so I'm now healed. So I don't do anything extreme. I love balance, and that's what I kind of encourage my patients as well. So I would say less animals and more plants, more fish over the, you know, four-legged animal is more inflammatory versus a two-legged animal versus a no-legged animal like a fish. So look at the legs. And what I would say is that you need to get your fats right. All fat isn't bad for the liver. The liver loves avocado and essential fatty acids, fish oil, avocado, nuts and seeds. What's very heavy, again, is the animal fats, the butter, the cream in the dairy and the meat and the fatty animal fats. So I would start with that. I mean, also, to even on lots of information on our my blogs at rejuve.co.uk, we have wellness water. So start the day, mix up big 2 liters to start flushing out the liver and gallbladder. And in that recipe on our blog, it has cinnamon, lemon, fresh mint leaves and ginger, drinking something like that. So start to flush out, give the body a chance. I mean, the body was designed to be well. And if you give it half a chance, it does an amazing job at healing itself. So removing, we often say at Rejuve, we do the triple R principle, remove what's causing the fatty liver. So the toxic high fatty foods, start to really encourage the hydration with something like our wellness water, and you'll have those ingredients in your kitchen cupboard. Mix that up and commit to 2 liters a day, and then swap out those nasty heavy fats for more of the vegetable versions, like the avocado, olives, extra virgin olive oil, things like that. So, you know, food is medicine. So start by doing that, and there's lots of different supplements you can take as well. Amazing herbs, like I started formulating 15 years ago. I just got sick of the vitamin industry becoming synthetic, so I have my own supplement line. So if you're looking for supplements, look for whole food, look for plant-based. Look on the back and say, oh, I recognize those ingredients, not like it just lists vitamins. So look for supplementation, something with milk thistle, nettle, with artichoke would be amazing.
Okay.
Eating those foods, garlic would be great as well.
Okay, and you didn't mention cutting out meat, which I found interesting. But a question, do vegans and vegetarians have less inflammation because they don't eat meat?
It depends. So I see a lot of vegans who then default to high carbohydrates, and in the end, they're filling up on the wrong type of grains, which causes equal inflammation. So when I say meat, I would say, look, if I'm treating a patient for fatty liver, I'll say, could you go pesca-vegan for the next month? Yes. No, I can't stand fish. Well, I don't operate as a naturopath for 23 years, and I hate suffering. So if someone just really it has an allergy or can't stand fish, there's always another way. So I would say limit red meat maybe once or twice a week if you love it. If you can go for a month or two without it, then your results will be faster. But I meet someone where they're at. But if you're used to having red meat every day and I say, right, no more meat for 3 months, they're going to have a really strong detox reaction, could have a Herxheimer, and they're going to have such a bad, rough ride, you lose the patient because it's too tough. So I like to always, as I said, so if you're a big, if for this lady, from one, if she's a big meat eater, cut it down to, you know, twice a month. If you're happy to abstain for a couple of months, go more pesca vegan. So I would say that, as I said, more plants, less animals, but I don't like to lock people in it. Wellness is a journey.
Yeah.
And if you're kind to yourself and you go up and over your mountain, it'll be elegant and you'll have beautiful, long-lasting results. If it's crash, fad, in and out, it's going to be, you're just going to keep doing laps around that mountain. You're never going to get free.
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Joining me is Dr. Simone from Rejuve Wellness. She's a doctor to many celebrities, including Kylie Jenner, Elle McPherson. Now, we are talking, we're talking about inflammation in the body. We're also talking about immune system. Now, Dr. Simone, I mean, everyone was talking, especially when the pandemic kicked, you know, to build your immune system up. It will help you from contracting COVID. What is the truth about building your immunity and why is it so important for us?
It's because the human body, as I said, was designed to be well. So we have an immune system with natural killer cells and white blood cells, which all work as a team. Whether it's a common cold or flu or, you know, any bacterial virus load, viral load. So that's been inherently with us to protect us since the beginning of time. So, you know, whether it's, you know, whether you're preparing going into the winter months or not, I mean, we all need to have a healthy immune system regardless of this pandemic and even before and long after it's gone, because the immune system will protect us. So if we take care of our gut, if we get the gut-brain axis good, and if we reduce doing things which reduce your good bacteria, so if we're eating lots of fiber as prebiotics, if we're eating more plants, as I said, less animals, lots of fruits and veggies, there's lots of things. We can do lots of colorful foods as well, particularly from the vegetables. Then those antioxidants build up and support our immune system's natural ability to fight any virus or bacteria. So by also getting our stress under control, choosing a form of exercise, you know, drinking our, like our Rejuve Wellness water that we spoke of before, getting our seven pillars in balance, then, you know, you're going to feel great and you're going to have a great immune system. You're going to be going to live longer, you're going to prevent disease. I think a lot of people obviously are focusing on the pandemic, rightly so, but there's still all the other diseases are still in the background, which is stemmed from a weakened immune system, from whether it's cancer or even, you know, getting illness and inflammation like heart disease. So yes, we need to be wise with our immune system, but we have to be setting ourselves up to win, play the long game with our health. And that means not forgetting about all the other, you know, diseases that, you know, which are rampant every day. So being wise, keeping ourselves strong, mind and body, and the immune system is a great friend, which will help us stay well mentally and physically.
Okay, so we've had a text from Zarina. She says, I have very low vitamin D levels. I'm taking supplements as prescribed by my doctor, but I don't see any improvement. I'm still lethargic. And I do suffer from fatigue sometimes, and it's been 5 weeks since I started taking the supplements. What else could be causing it?
Great question, Zarina. I see so many clients here living, obviously coming from the UK and living here, and there's so much sunshine, but we all become very cautious with the sun for obvious reasons with skin cancer. And I see a lot of clients which are particularly severely low, even lower here than I would see with my patients in the UK. So what I would say, the best form of vitamin D, yes, you can supplement, it's wise, many people do, it does work. There's a few things. Vitamin D is a fat-soluble vitamin. So when you're taking your supplement, make sure you marry it in with a fatty food. So a good fat, like avocado, olives, or you're having it with a meal with some nice extra virgin olive oil, make sure you're supporting the supplementation at that time with your diet. Number two, look, you know, we do have access to gorgeous sunshine. You don't have to put yourself at risk of skin cancer. You can get out in the early morning or the late afternoon and put a major muscle group into the sun in the privacy of your own home if you prefer, meaning like your legs, to get fantastic reaction of the sunshine with the cholesterol in our skin, which forms the perfect bioavailable form of D3. As I said, of course we can supplement, but nature has it all for us if we will take, be wise and get good quality sunshine. And I think in addition to that, all of our fat-soluble vitamins, vitamins A, D, E, and K will work as a team with that. But don't forget about absorption. We used to say you are what you eat. Now we say you are what you absorb. So maybe your gut needs some support. You need to actually support the function of the digestive system, whether it's learning to chew better or taking something like our digestive support capsules to support the enzymes in the gut. Then we need to think about the absorption. You know, we wouldn't drive our car for 40 years and not service the engine. The human body is the same. We need functional support and the right fuel. So make sure your digestive system is working well. That's a big player, particularly in vitamin D. And the last little thing is check your thyroid, because often any issue with hyperthyroidism is linked to vitamin D as well. So maybe have a look and check your relating back to hormones again, hey, looking at the thyroid.
Oh, everything is so related to hormones. Is it true that, you know, they say women are more hormonal than men? Now, obviously, we say that and we are more emotional, but is it true, or do men have as many hormones as we do?
Look, I actually wrote it on our rejuve.co.uk. I have a full blog on inflammation and hormones, so there's lots of information there. But look, we have our estrogen and progesterone always in balance on the kind of the top layer, and then we also have a small thin layer of testosterone underneath. So we really have a dynamic of two big players and then another player, a third player. So men will also still have estrogen, progesterone and testosterone, but they don't have that fluctuation due to our cycle that we will have. So, you know, whether it's influenced by the moon based on the level of volume, water volume in our body, that'll affect our cycle. Obviously, our periods, premenopause, perimenopause, or just, you know, in normal healthy, you know, young girls with, you know, with period pain or bits and bobs. So we have our menstrual cycle in flux every day of the month. So we're always on a journey every month. The boys are just kind of in the background and nothing kind of upsets them. They're just like motoring through.
They're so lucky.
Up and over the mountain, and we're like doing 20 laps to get to the same destination. It's like, oh my goodness.
You know, it's funny. You mentioned the moon. Last week when it was a full moon, I had three girlfriends saying, I don't feel right. It must be the full moon. And they all put it down to that.
Yeah, well, don't forget also parasites. We do a full moon pack and a parasite gut cleanse with my patients. Because so don't forget, for the full moon, we have our hormonal fluctuations. But don't forget, parasites hatch on a full moon. It's the perfect environment where our serotonin goes up, our melatonin goes down, which is why often we have trouble sleeping on the full moon. Ah. And as a result, we can get a lot of gut activity, and that can make us feel really out of sorts. In fact, my husband, gosh, he was on so many antidepressants and things coming out of the UK. He's South African. He doesn't do very well with cloudy days. He's thriving here. But his trigger, and, you know, he took the antidepressants, but they were doing nothing until we determined it was actually his gut. And he had a family of 19 parasites with three generations in his gut.
What?
And what they do is they eat your food and they poop back into your system, producing something called a mycotoxin. So I strongly advise, if you have a child who has learning or behavioral problems, or a spouse or anyone around you seriously with any sort of mood or depression, anxiety disorders, then I'd strongly advise, please look at the gut, because it is a massive trigger. I treat so many children for behavioral problems, and literally within 3 months, the child is like night and day. It is miraculous.
Wow. So next time I'm in a mood, don't blame it on my hormones. Blame it on the parasites, according to Dr. Simone.
Healthy Habits
on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
So I've just had a text in about somebody's ankle Isaac text because he was talking about, we were talking about my ankle, and he says, it's a great session. Thank you. Thanks, Isaac, for listening. He says, I have an ankle inflammation and now I understand it's stress related. Had some family in ICU for some time, so I think that added to the pain, and he did some tests, but he was also told it could be rheumatoid arthritis, but he doubts it. So he's saying, what are the best exercises to ensure no impact on mobility? I just want to say to Isaac, I had homeopath that helped me a little bit, but I was walking a lot and I'd get tired very easily on that ankle. So what would you recommend to Isaac?
Yeah, great question, Isaac. Thank you so much. But first of all, before you go down the road of medication and rheumatoid and things like that, I would always look at all the other major players and look at your diet and lifestyle. So I would look at our seven. We can even do a free wellness quiz with us at rejuve.co.uk, which targets out of the seven wellness pillars, what are your three to focus on? So that might be a blessing and help you to balance out and see maybe what the other triggers are. And one of our pillars is movement. So out of that pillar, I would suggest that you do weight supportive exercise. So if you're, just imagine the ankle is trying to heal, but it's like one half you're hugging the ankle and using ice and helping it and calming it down and helping it to heal. The other side, you're running on the treadmill and you're punching it. So one side you're loving it, the next minute you're punching it. So it will need rest, you need to reduce your weight bearing, which is just your weight on your ankle. So if you want to still be doing your exercise, choose something maybe like an exercise bike, a rowing machine, a cross trainer. So you're still getting the cardio benefits, but you're not exercising for that 30 minutes to an hour with your weight on your ankle.
Yeah, swimming is also good, isn't it? Swimming is good
amazing.
For you.
Amazing. Yeah. Particularly the ocean. Don't forget. Actually, I just did a blog for Cora Organics all about the sea. The sea is so healing.
Oh, I agree.
Mind, body, you name it.
I agree.
So chlorine pools, yes, but load up on your home plant-based vitamin C before and after to close your cells to the chlorine. But really getting in the sea would be amazing as well for swimming. But, yeah, look at those seven pillars and maybe do our quiz, as I said, at rejuve.co.uk. That'll really help you target in. It's a bit overwhelming to think, oh, my gosh, seven things. But if you know top three things to think about, and then you're really kind. I mean, we also recommend far infrared saunas. For me, I have a portable one in my home. I love that kind of hot cold therapy, which is really great for inflammation and healing as well. And yes, stress and being mindful and staying in that place. And even when stress can be triggering you, always coming back to what I coach my patients with that. I call it Isaac, your island. Go back onto Isaac Island. Breathe, use your breath, calm the nervous system down. So talk to that ankle, you know, and calm the nervous system down to support healing. Look at those pillars and also weight supportive exercise.
Okay, so we have another question, no name. How can you tell if you have parasites? Is there a test you can do to determine this? I have a feeling all of us have them. Is that right?
Yeah, we all have them, and it's part of our microbiome. It's good and bad bacteria, and that's fine. We all live and cohabit very nicely. We have even our own home has a microbiome. It just means a mini ecosystem.
Yeah.
So, yes, we all have a degree of parasites, absolutely. And if you see my Instagram page at rejuve_wellness, particularly last month, even Elle McPherson joined me and a whole bunch of friends and patients. We had some pretty interesting, and at my Instagram page as well. If you have a weak stomach, don't have a look, but it was amazing. So, yes, we all have them. We do our Rejuve 10-point urine test. You can do a stool test as well because we're looking to see not only parasites, but something which is quite sinister underneath as well is fungus and candida. So that can really play havoc, everything from my fertility patients, gut, IBS, cancer, you name it. So, yes, we all have it. You'll probably know you do. You could be feeling lethargic, angry, irritable, craving lots of junk, sugar or carbs or fatty foods. You could be feeling just kind of out of sorts, as I said, but definitely gut issues. You might be more diarrhea or constipation, but overall feeling flat and just kind of, you've lost your va-va-voom.
Lost your mojo.
Don't forget there is that. Yeah, yeah, you're kind of in a constant funk. You kind of wake up thinking, am I better?
Oh, I'm so guys, funk. If you're out there and you've lost your mojo, it's okay, you've just got parasites. They're having a mojo in your body.
Take out Reju Ferroclense herbs. Don't worry. Pop to the organic food cafe and buy some or go online.
So let's just say somebody's feeling all those conditions right now. Like you said, they could wake up in the morning, just kind of flush out the system with some good water and just kind of kickstart that a little bit, right? Because some of these parasites, they're going to be in our body because it's natural.
Yes, but you do need antibacterial and antifungal herbs. So definitely start with flushing up with water. That's fantastic for the 11 systems. Add in lots of garlic, ginger, and pumpkin seeds are very good antiviral and antibacterial. But if you have any of those feelings, you'll probably need to use some herbs like in our Power Cleanse capsules just for 30 days. Load up pre and post full moon. It's all on our blog, and it's you know, as I said, you can find it easy on our website at rejuve.co.uk. It's not overly complicated. We keep it simple. But, and of course, food is medicine, but it's don't be overwhelmed. It's something which is easy. And all we're doing is shifting the balance of power. We're boosting the good guys and calming down the good and the bad guys. It's not about this war on parasites. We just want balance again. And it's quite easy just using some herbs to reset that balance, increasing your pre and probiotics, adding in your antiviral, antiparasitics, and that's it. Job done.
I think we can all live together as one, us humans and parasites. We'll be fine. We'll be fine. Dr. Simone, it has been a riveting. That's all I can say. I've learned a lot. Thank you so much for joining us, and hopefully we'll have you on again soon.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Healthy Habits
on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
We're now going to talk to a dietitian, and we're talking about something which I really don't know anything about. It's called leaky gut syndrome. I've heard about it, but maybe I've just never heard anyone who's had it, so I don't really know what it is. Now, what I do know, I did a bit of a read up, is that it's basically a digestive condition that affects the lining of an intestines. And just to confirm that, I have the expert herself, Jordana Venski, who is a dietitian from JV Nutrition. She's the founder of JV Nutrition. How are you, Jordana?
I'm very well. Thank you, Poonam. Thanks for having me.
So my description of a leaky gut, is that correct? I'm sure you can expand on that. Tell us more. What exactly is it?
So that definition of a leaky gut is actually quite a tricky one. When we look at it, it's not really a syndrome as much as it is a symptom of something that's going on in the body. So in kind of more of the medical world, we look at it and we say that there isn't really such a thing as a leaky gut syndrome. What we understand is that the gut contains a lining that has been carefully designed to allow certain things in and to keep certain things out. And so what we're meant to be allowing in is the nutrition aspect, and we should be keeping out things like toxins or bacteria or other pathogens. But really what can ultimately happen is that because there is this permeability, what we call that allowance within the gut, sometimes if we haven't been kind of following correct eating, for example, or lifestyle, certain things within our lifestyle, then we can increase that permeability. And then that's when we can possibly start to see some kind of disorders happening.
So how do you know if you have it? What will you feel? What are some of the symptoms?
So generally, we wouldn't be saying that you have leaky gut syndrome. What we would be saying is that people might be complaining a little bit more of bloating. They might be having some more diarrhea. They might be having some nausea. They might be suffering from constipation or from diarrhea. And then that would start to kind of flag little signs for us to do some more investigations. And then we can start to see, is there more of an IBS happening? Is there some more chronic conditions of the gut happening? Or is it really that we have to really focus on those lifestyle conditions? So focusing on our sleep, our stress, and then what we're actually eating.
Well, they say, I have heard the term, the gut is like the second brain, which means if that is not functioning, the body's, it's not going to work because it's such a big thing of the body, right?
Yeah, exactly. So the gut is basically a second brain. And when we look at the gut-brain connection, there's a massive connection between the two of them. There's actually a nerve that runs between the brain and the gut. The other thing that's happening in the gut is that we have around 80% of our immune system actually sitting in our digestive system.
Oh.
As soon as that starts to be inflamed, that's automatically going to have an inflammatory response within our body. And so this is what is going to be kind of shooting out these triggers of there's bloating, there's that constipation, diarrhea, things I've mentioned, but also sometimes things like headaches. We're now starting to see in research, even things like anxiety and depression can be attributed to what's actually happening in the gut.
Yeah, the body is so connected. This is the thing. I do think everything is connected, and we can't just eliminate one thing and say it's that. You do have to look at it as a whole. Now, can anyone suffer from leaky gut at any age, or is it more susceptible to certain people?
So anybody can be suffering with digestive issues, really, at any age. So even a young baby through to kind of your older person sitting at 70, 80 years old. And it's really looking at what's going on within them. Sometimes there is an element of genetics that's there, and other times it's really just purely looking at the lifestyle that that person is leading.
So as a dietitian, you've obviously had clients come to you and they've realized they have, you know, a leaky gut. What is it that you do? What's some of the practices that you do to eliminate this condition and just heal them?
First off, sometimes I would send them straight to a gastroenterologist first off to get some proper testing done. And this testing would be kind of focusing if we think that there might be some short, some SIBO, some short intestine bowel obstruction. Then we would be sending them through for a breath test. We might be sending them for a colonoscopy. I would never, ever be doing food intolerances at all, food intolerance testings. And then from there, it would be, right, we've either got a medical reason or we can kind of primarily just look at the diet and the lifestyle. And then we kind of looking at very simple things is what actually are you eating? What are you putting into your system that's going to be allowing that digestive system to be working better or to be affecting the digestive system and kind of creating it to work in a not so healthy way? And unfortunately, the way that most people eat nowadays, we're not eating well to be feeding that gut bacteria, which is essentially helping to determine our health.
Yeah, I think so many of us eat takeout food too. I mean, I grew up with homemade food. I think that plays a big part in it too, don't you think?
It's a huge, huge part. I find particularly here in the UAE, one of the things that I really kind of battle with sometimes with clients is just trying to get them to eat more real food again.
Yeah.
If you kind of look at or have a conversation with anybody, everybody's got the all of the delivery apps on their phones, and it's almost trying to get them back to, can we stop deleting some of them and get back to actually just buying food and cooking food at home?
I know.
It doesn't need to be difficult.
No. I love cooking. When it comes to water, you know, they always say you should have 8 glasses or 6 glasses, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. Does that play a big part? Because I can tell you this much. I am like a camel. I don't need hardly any water each day. And people think it's a bit weird. Now, does someone like me need to listen to my body, or should I be having 6 to 8 glasses a day, like everyone says?
You should be having roughly 6 to 8 glasses a day. And there is a formula that we can work that's specifically done in your weight. But it is roughly going to be around 6 to 8 glasses per day. And this has more got to do with, again, what's happening in your digestive system. You might not feel like you need water, but your body's really looking for it. And so then we'll start to look at toilet habits, for example, and actually see, are you getting enough? Or should we be increasing your amount?
Okay, I think I need to come and visit you and we'll have this chat, not on the radio.
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Welcome back to the show. Poonam Verma with you till 5 p.m. Now, we've been talking about leaky gut syndrome. I had no idea what it was, but I am joined by dietitian Jordana Wenski, who is with us. And she's been explaining quite a lot to me. Now, Jordana, once you get it, will it keep coming back?
So if you don't change any habits, then you're going to keep continuously going to kind of have issues with your digestive system. It's a thing of that if I'm able to change my habits and put certain things into play, then my digestive system can start working the way that we want it to be working and at its optimal rate. And so we then start to become healthier. And that's often the drive that keeps people continuing with these habits, is that they notice the visible kind of way that they look and in the way that they're feeling in terms of once I've changed my diet and certain lifestyle habits.
Now, I know it can also contribute, because I read up about this, it can contribute towards health issues such as IBS, allergies. What other things does it contribute to and, you know, probably make worse?
Yeah, so unfortunately, what you've been reading isn't necessarily always the kind of whole truth. When we actually look at science, there isn't any science yet in saying how much it would be contributing to these diseases or these kind of syndromes. It's really looking at that, yes, we might be kind of opening a door towards more of these, but how much it contributes, we're not quite sure at this point in time. But certainly we all have to be looking at gut health, and there's so much research going on at the minute about gut health, and there's a lot of information coming out that we really need to be clever in the way that we're reading that information and understanding that information.
I know a lot of people, you know, they will see a new diet or, you know, a juice diet, and they say, right, I'm going to clear my gut and I'm going to do this. I'm not a big fan of that, because I think everybody's body's different, so diets don't work on everybody the same way. Would you always recommend people come and see a dietitian and sit down and have a proper assessment?
Yeah, absolutely. I'd always be recommending that individual approach. There is no one size fits all. If there was, we would all be kind of living these perfect lifestyles and having like these perfect health. So it's very much so that you do need to get that individual take on things. There are some across the board guidelines, but then it's how we start to personalize within those guidelines for you and what's actually going on within your own body. If we just look at the bacteria, for example, in your digestive system, person A might have an overgrowth of one type of bacteria and person B might have an overgrowth of another bacteria, but now they're both taking the same kind of probiotic to help cure their levels, but that probiotic isn't going to be helping both of those bacteria, for example. So it's really looking at that individual approach.
What are some of the things we can do in the meantime to prevent it so we don't ever experience this syndrome?
Yeah, so it's looking at starting off with very, very basic things, actually, starting with your lifestyle. So making sure that you're actually getting enough sleep, looking at the timing of your sleep. So trying to go to bed at the same time, roughly the same time at night time, and waking up at the same time in the morning.
So let me ask you, what is the amount of sleep depending on your age as well?
So depending on your age, if you're an adult, we're wanting about those 8 to 9 hours per day.
Wow.
If you're a teenager, we're actually wanting a little bit more. So it's no surprise that teenagers generally want to be sleeping later in the morning. Toddlers, that young childhood, they tend to need a little bit less, so they can be working more in that kind of 10 hours or so. But so sleep is something that we can't catch up on, and it's something that's so incredibly important to our health that we all take complete advantage of it.
Okay.
But the biggest thing with sleep is actually making sure that you're waking up at the same time and going to bed at the same time. And then the first thing that you do after, well, when you wake up in the morning, is not to pick up your phone and not to check your social media and do all of that stuff. It's actually go outside and get some sunlight on your face.
That's what I do. I do that.
Yeah, so it really does help with our overall health and maintaining that gut health as well.
Wow, that's really interesting. So go and get some sun first thing in the morning. Don't go onto social media or put the TV on. And like, how long should you just sit outside? Just a few minutes just to get that sun on your face?
A few minutes, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, that's it. It doesn't need to be a long period of time. And it's just to help get that vitamin D in, and so that your body is able to start working with that circadian rhythm that it actually needs to function appropriately.
That's amazing. No one's ever said that. They always say, get up and have some water in the first thing in the morning. And you're saying, go out and have the sun.
Get outside. Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's amazing. So if anybody wanted to come and see you, how can they get in touch with you?
They can get in touch with me through my Instagram. So it's JD_nutrition. Or they can email me at hello@jordana.life.
All right. And you are the founder of JV Nutrition. You can find that also online. Thank you so much, Jordana. I think I might need to pay a visit to you soon.
See you soon.
Thank you. That was Jordana Wenske, who is dietitian. So if you've got any issues when it comes to leaky gut syndrome, she's the lady to contact.
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Well, we're now talking about accidents and emergencies. Have you ever been to the A&E department? Have you been told that this isn't an emergency? So I am now joined by Dr. Akram Abodak, and he's emergency medicine and head of emergency department at Gargash Hospital. How are you, doctor, today?
How are you? Fine.
Are you tired? Have you come off a long shift? Or you got enough energy to talk to me?
Yeah, it's a bit, but it's okay. We can manage.
Okay, so I'm taking time. I know you're a busy, busy man. Tell me a typical day in the life of in ER. Is it exactly how George Clooney did it or not?
Yeah, actually, I went to this specialty because of George Clooney.
Oh, tell me more. Did he encourage you and inspire you?
Yeah, he inspired. Actually, this specialty is like something like interesting, and it's like full of activity, and you know, it's like every day is like a new day in your like career and in your like how to develop your skills. So every day will face something new, something interesting, different than the other specialties, which is like somehow is like typical, like, but honestly speaking, it's like not all the time we get such really an emergency cases in the emergency departments. Sometimes it's a bit like non-emergency.
A non-emergency. So let me ask you a question. What do you constitute as an emergency? Because I can imagine there's a lot of people that come in and you're thinking, okay, this isn't really an emergency, but it's okay. Because if you are really, really busy and you have people coming in where they think it's not really an emergency, doesn't that delay everything for you?
Yeah, actually, what happened is like we cannot tell the people not to come because we cannot depend on their evaluation whether this...
Yeah.
Complain is an emergency or no. But some people, when they come to the ER, they think as they are in the ER, their case, regardless of the case, it's an emergency. This is why there is like the emergency, like let's say a program developed like a triage system where we can receive any patient regardless of their complaint. But then we sort them in categories. There is like two or three system of triaging, but at the end of the day, they are the same. They are like the aim is to sort the patient in this category where we can find how much acute is their case. So like if the patient is having category, let's say three or four, we can still receive them. They can be like something like simple flu. We can still receive them. Category 5, like someone who is coming to do, let's say, a general checkup.
Mm.
Or someone who is like looking to have like a medication refill because they run out from their medication. So still we can receive them, especially in the night time where the clinic are closed. Sometimes people, they have like need to refill their medication. So still we can. But patients should understand that they can wait because if we are free, for sure, they will take the priority. But if we have like someone who is more critical, we will give the priority to see that patient. Yeah. So this is the concept of the how we work. And this is why sometimes someone who is having like a simple wound and let's say for his son or daughter, they will come and sometimes they scream. It's like an emergency.
Yeah.
But it's like simple. We can just put a simple dressing and they can wait.
Yeah.
Because I have maybe a head trauma where the patient is having intracranial bleeding.
Mm.
And that guy, I need to give him the priority. Yeah. So this is like the conflict between us and patients sometimes.
You must have to stay very calm to be in the A&E department. I'm not a calm person. I'd panic. Does that come naturally to you, or are doctors trained to stay calm during emergencies?
You know, the more calm is the doctor in the emergency, the more like he is having knowledge and confident, and the more he can manage the patient without mistakes, let's say.
So how calm are you on a level of 0 to 10, with 10 being the calmest?
My staff, they are telling me you are so cold.
Oh. So, okay, I won't be coming to you.
Sometimes they think I don't know what to do.
Oh, yeah.
We try to be as calm as possible.
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
So, Dr. Akram, let me ask you a question. During COVID, the pandemic, especially when it kicked off, I know there are separate hospitals and separate wards for COVID patients. But did you find less people coming into A&E because they were afraid of catching COVID at any hospital?
I was like a bit weird, and we were like internally discussing this, like where were those people who is coming like every day for abdominal pain, for chest pain, I got dizziness, I got this and that.
Yeah.
And that time really we didn't receive much like cases, which is really not emergency. The only cases that we've received like is the real emergency cases where the patient is really stuck and he really needs the emergency services. But at the end, as I told you, I don't personally prefer to tell the people don't come to ER because this is like, let's say, simple headache, because I cannot rely on their like judgment.
Yes.
Sometimes really people come and they are like pushed by one of the family member or friends to come because they think it's like really silly complaint. Then we end up with something serious. So this is why I would like to like give like a brief about there is something what we call red flag. So it's even for us as doctors or healthcare provider.
Mm-hmm.
Once we hear this, we know that this is really could be serious. Like, so any chest pain, I cannot say this is like muscular, take Panadol, take like whatever, like paracetamol or like whatever painkiller. So this any chest pain should be really evaluated regardless of the timing of the, like if you are busy, if not, if it's like nighttime, you don't have the access, simply you can call 999 and they will at least they will come and they will evaluate the patient. At least they will do an ECG and they can like see if it's like really serious or no. Something like unilateral weakness, any weakness on the one side of the body or like facial deviation.
Because that could be like a stroke.
Slurred speech. This is really top emergency. This should not be underestimated.
Yes.
Like, yeah. The other thing is someone who is having like any altered mental status, like the level of consciousness is a little bit down. He's like confused, even if for brief, like seconds, this should be also evaluated to rule out any stroke.
Okay.
Then we'll go to the red flags. Like red flags, any disease associated with vomiting, we consider it more serious than if someone have abdominal pain with vomiting.
Oh.
If I compare it with someone with abdominal pain without vomiting, I would be more like cautious with dealing with someone who is having the vomiting, headache with vomiting, headache with fever. So vomiting, fever, seizure, and severe, like if the symptom is severe, like if anything, like severe headache, severe, let's say, chest pain, severe, pain, back pain, severe abdominal pain, those should be really evaluated in the ER.
So we shouldn't feel silly thinking, oh, this might be something small. If your really intuition is telling you something big, head to A&E.
Yeah, it's like for any complaint, if it's like, let's say if we have someone who is having flu, if the flu is okay, like only like a low grade fever, like little body ache, some throat pain, it's okay. But if there is difficulty of breathing associated, this means that this could be serious. And this is what we found in COVID. Like a lot of patients, they deteriorate quickly because they have, like when we go in the history, they will say that he has this flu. And there is difficulty of breathing, but we think it's normal. It's like from blocked nose or whatever. Then when they come to the ER, we found that there is like, you know, like pneumonia or like even like ARDS or like something like which is really serious.
Yeah.
So those red flags is the one who guide us to go quickly to the ER or to wait to get an appointment.
Okay, well, doctor, thank you so much for your red flags. I hope everyone heard that. If you have any of those, don't hesitate to go to ER. I'm going to have to go to the news shortly, but just let me ask you, does this constitute as an A&E in emergency? This happened to me a few years ago. I got a fishbone stuck down my throat and it scratched me and I went to A&E. Would you have taken me?
Yeah. I would take you. This is like really sometimes it's serious. It could block the airway. It could like, yeah.
But you'll be happy to know I lived to tell the tale and I'm still talking. So that's good news, right? Doctor, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Healthy Habits
on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
So we're talking self-compassion. Let's find out. Zina, how much self-compassion do you have for yourself?
Probably zero.
That's so bad. We need to change that. We now have a psychologist with us, Mamta Saha, and we're going to be talking about self-compassion. But let's start with saying hello. How are you, Mamta?
Hello, Bloom. It's lovely to be on air with you. I'm very well, thank you. I hope you are too.
Yeah, very good. Long time no see. We know each other, but we haven't seen each other for so, so long. So let me talk about compassion. What exactly is self-compassion?
So compassion in the layman's terms is when we cut ourselves some slack in life. If we've made mistakes, if we've made a schoolboy error in regards to anything, we don't beat ourselves up about it. We're actually reflective and kind to ourselves about the choices that we made. We learn from them and we move forward.
Okay, but let's just say someone might say, well, self-compassion is just feeling sorry for yourself. What would you say to that?
It really isn't. It's about not feeling sorry for yourself, but being gentle on yourself. Often what we can do is be our own worst enemies. We can be our biggest critics. We can beat ourselves up mentally over small little errors that we might have made, or even big mistakes or choices that we may have made in life. And that's okay in a split second, but I think over time, that can really impact our self-esteem, our self-worth, our self-love, and our confidence.
So can you help Zina right now? Because she says she has zero self-compassion. What would you say to somebody like Zina?
Why am I the case study here?
She is the case study. Let's use her and abuse her right now.
What I would say to Zina is, and it's really common because we're often conditioned and grow up to suck it up, get on, thick skin, stiff upper lip, all of these cultural things that we've heard banded about. And I think what I would say to Zina and what I'd love to say to Zina is, what's at stake in terms of your vitality and clarity of thought if you stay in a place of being, having a lack of compassion for yourself? What's at stake if this continues?
Zina?
Obviously, my mental health. You keep thinking about your mistakes and sometimes they make you feel like an awful individual and that becomes your truth, right? But it's interesting that you say that those are, cultural factors. There are cultural factors that lead you to question yourself and your ability. So that's really interesting.
And what's funny is like me and Zina were having a chat just before you came on, Mamta, and I said to her, let's say you made a mistake. And I'd say, Zina, it's fine. Don't worry about it. If I did it, I would have said, oh, you're so silly. How did you do that and not think about it?
Well, this is the thing. I think that we're actually brilliant at extending kindness to other people. And if someone comes to us vulnerable and courageous enough to say, things aren't great for me, we're very quick to wrap our compassionate arms around them, obviously at a social distance. But when it comes to ourselves, actually, interestingly, there's a lot of psychology around the barriers to being self-compassionate. People think it's an absolute weakness. People also think that if they become compassionate and kind to themselves, they might actually regress and be less motivated, less driven to achieve the things that they want to achieve.
That makes sense.
And so we don't go there.
Yeah. That makes sense because it's like you're being soft on yourself, but you need to keep pushing yourself. So be a bit hard on yourself, whereas self-compassion feels like, oh, you're mollycoddling somebody, you know?
Exactly. And I think the important thing to note here is all the research says that people who do take a little bit of time turning that internal critical narrative into a more reflective, kinder narrative are better the next time around. They're more mindful, they're more astute, they're more aware, they're kinder to themselves, and they're less likely to make the same mistake over again if they are that bit more compassionate and kinder to themselves.
So how self-compassionate are you towards Mamta?
Me?
Yes.
Actually, I am so much more compassionate than I have been in my whole life in the last sort of 5 years, I would say. And I think I had to learn the hard way. I think there were many red flags that came up from a health perspective that I didn't pay attention to until one morning I woke up and my life drastically changed. And I had to question a lot about how harsh I was being to myself. I'm a psychologist. So by profession, by trade, it's my job to be there for people, to be in the trenches. But when it came to myself, oh no, I wasn't doing any of it because I had to be the thick skin one and I had to be the one that was holding the fort for people. And actually what happened as a result is that I became my own worst enemy. And I wasn't really there for myself. And I suffered as a consequence. Mm. My mental health suffered. My physical health suffered. My emotional health suffered. And so now, Bunam, I'm very mindful. I'm very, very mindful of the narrative that I have, how much time I spend ruminating over mistakes, and really how quick I am to then leverage off them and move forward. So things have changed for me and I had to learn the hard way.
Yeah, well, I think the hard way, making us feel uncomfortable, is what pushes us to the next level to evolve. And it is a balance of give and take.
Healthy Habits
on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
So talking about self-compassion, I have psychologist Mamta Saha with us. Let me ask you a question. During COVID, Mamta, what happened with people's self-compassion? Did you notice differences with your clients? Go ahead.
Interestingly, during COVID, the clients that I've had for a long time had actually were very compassionate, were really compassionate. They had a strong internal dialogue. Of course, it was challenging, but they were kind to themselves. They took advantage of the fact that they had the space and time that they craved for in their busy lives. And the newer clients struggled. They struggled with maintaining a balance between being kind to themselves and living up to the pressure and the expectations that they felt were set on them. So I think for a lot of people, there was a lot of self-doubt, a lot of judgment, quite a lot of harshness and expectation around what they needed to deliver.
Mm.
Can you hear me, Poonam?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Yeah. So, you know, when we worked on their internal narrative, because so much of self-compassion has to do with what we're telling ourselves. In fact, that's a lot of it. And we put in place some interventions, some reflections they could do. So daily journaling, some gratitude, affirmations, etc. It actually helped them to create a little bit of space between that critical narrative and being kinder to themselves and cutting themselves the slack that they really needed to do, to then find a way to progress forward from being in that negative space.
Well, I've just had a really, really good text, and this affects a lot of people who work in the medical field. They basically said, you know, making a mistake, let's say if you're a doctor, a nurse, or, you know, with anyone's health, it could mean somebody else's life. So there is that other way to feel really upset, and you can beat yourself up for days, which I can imagine that would happen to me. And you feel so responsible because you're human at the end of the day. And it's not easy just to have self-compassion in that case, especially, let's say, if you're trying to save somebody's life. You know, how do you deprogram? Not deprogram, but I don't know how you'd come back out of that, because I know as a doctor, you know, you probably see it every day and it gets to a point that it naturally affects you, but you have to get on with your job. So where does the self-compassion come in a situation like this?
Yeah, so self-compassion is not about detaching yourself from caring or reflecting on mistakes you may have made. It's quite the opposite. It's absolutely taking ownership, accountability, but then, you know, being very conscious not to invite that negative narrative into those reflections and sitting in that place. So it's about saying, you know, yes, I've made a mistake. yes, this mistake has consequences. Yes, it's cost someone's life, or it's impacting me that it, unfortunately it's led to that, which is, you know, I cannot imagine. I've not been in that position. However, it's being in a place of thinking about, okay, I'm taking personal responsibility for this. I want to reflect on what I could have done better. So it's coming away from being subjective around that, being objective around that, learning and thinking about, okay, what am I going to be doing differently next time? How am I going to learn from this? How am I going to leverage from this place where I am now? And how am I going to move forward from it? Non-judgmentally, in a supportive way, you know, you to sit in that place of being self-destructive as opposed to being self-compassionate actually stagnates you from being able to learn from what has happened. The reality is life will always have challenges. Some challenges can appear and feel and are more severe than others. The point is, and the choice is, do we stay in a place where we don't move forward from it, or do we reflect and actually use self-compassion to understand, to learn, to reflect, and to grow in order to be able to move forward?
Okay, well, Manal, thank you so much, Manal, for your text there. And just briefly, can you sum up in like a minute, like some of the top three things we could do to help with self-compassion? I know journaling is a good thing to do, right?
Absolutely. In fact, yes, I have something that I'd love to share with you. So there's been a lot of research that's been conducted about sharing our reflections in a group context. Now, what I'm not encouraging is, unless you want to, that is going online on IG Live and sharing, you know, the mistake that you may have made. But speak to people that you trust. Confide in people that you know that will listen to you, will give you a listening ear. Because when you do that, you invite them to do the same thing. And actually, there's something around human connectivity that's actually quite healing from within. So the tips are around come away from self-hatred, come away from giving yourself a stigma and being isolated, speak to people that you trust, journal, think, extract the learnings. What am I learning from this? How is this issue detached from my self-worth? So stop defining yourself by that mistake. Separate your self-worth from what has actually happened. Think about how you can incorporate compassion in your daily life so that you don't get to the point where a lot of people do, where I did, as I was saying earlier, where actually you have to go on a self-compassion indulgence, you know, to be able to feel better about yourself. How can you start to incorporate? How can you start to cut yourself some slack and incorporate that self-compassion into everyday life?
Okay, well, Mamta,
what is the narrative that you can adopt?
Mamta, how can people contact you if they want to have a session with you?
So reach out to me. It's mamtasaha.com is my website. And I'm also on Instagram under saha_mamta. And please do reach out. This is I'd love to hear from people. And I think we need to get into a self-compassionate movement because we don't do enough of it. We're too hard on ourselves.
We are indeed. Mamta, thank you. Thank you so much.
Healthy Habits
on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Now, to calm down the rest of the half an hour, we're going to be talking about wellness and we're going to be in a space of Zen. And I'm now talking to Rachel Dowse. She's the co-founder of Beyond Wellness and they've basically created retreats. Rachel is with us now. Rachel, how are you?
Hi, I'm very well, thank you. Really nice to join you.
Now, you're a brave mom because you've literally given birth and you have your four-week-old with you right now, yes?
That's correct, yes, I do.
Yeah, so how are you feeling?
I'm feeling very good, actually. I'm feeling good. We're having lots of fun days out at the moment and enjoying Dubai as we can at the moment in the sun.
Well, that's great because I know that you're trying to make everyone feel as good as you're sounding right now with your wellness retreats. But I love the story about, you know, how you came to this. Tell everybody what you and your co-founder, Sophie, used to do and why these wellness retreats began.
Okay. So, yeah, it's quite an interesting story, actually. Sophia and I worked together for a long while in the world of corporate here in the region. We've both been here for 10 or 11 years. And we obviously, like most people here, we work hard and we play hard. We worked 6-day weeks. We were traveling a lot. Mm-hmm. And at the end of it, we both got quite, we both had enough, really. Sophia got quite sick and she got cancer, and we kind of just decided from our own experiences that it was, we really wanted to support other people on kind of their wellness journeys. Yeah. And we wanted to support them to feel good and to feel better despite whatever they were experiencing in their kind of work life environment. So we started helping corporate individuals and helping them with wellness in the workplace. And yeah. then from there, it very naturally, organically kind of moved to a wellness retreat concept. So it's mind and body, spirit. And our journey's very, very much changed. Sophia became a life coach.
Wow.
And I became a clinical hypnotherapist and psychotherapist. And kind of on our journeys of experiencing lots of different retreats around the world, beautiful, luxurious retreats, whether they were yoga or meditation or detox, we both kind of really realized that the kind of fundamental mental and emotional aspects weren't really being considered in the retreat.
Mm-hmm.
And we really wanted to bring those into the retreats that we were creating here. So that's how Beyond Wellness was born.
So when did it actually start, Beyond Wellness?
Well, our journey started long into the time we were in corporate, which is around 6 years ago. But officially, in terms of the retreats, we've been doing those for a couple of years now. And we're really excited because we were global before. And then obviously the COVID situation has hit us quite hard and we couldn't travel. So yeah. we decided to start the retreats here in the UAE. And we haven't looked back. We're so busy at the moment. We just had a retreat at Alcasa, which is fantastic. We had 40 people there with us. And we have a Maldives retreat coming up at the end of August, so we're super excited about that.
Don't tempt me. Please, Rachel, don't tempt me to the Maldives. You know I want to come.
I think everyone needs to do that once in their lifetime, for
oh,
sure.
Yeah, no, Maldives is my favourite place, actually. But let me ask you a question. We're very lucky to live in the UAE because you can do so many retreats at so many beautiful hotels, right? So I think, you know, during COVID, that's been a bit of a saviour for us in many ways. But what have you noticed during the pandemic? I've noticed a lot of people have just kind of woken up thinking, I don't want to do this job anymore, or, you know, there's more to life than this. What have you noticed?
Oh, absolutely. Well, as a clinical hypnotherapist and psychotherapist, my work is understanding where people are emotionally and mentally. And I've really seen, obviously, a rise in stress and anxiety for people. You know, they're very worried about their jobs. They're also isolated away from their families.
Yeah.
And that's causing a lot of pressure on individuals. I think it's kind of created what we might call a bit of an awakening.
Yes.
You know? People are deciding enough is enough. This is not what I want to do anymore. And I need to also focus on my health. And I need to focus on my wellness. So the retreats are a really fantastic way to do that. Stress and anxiety is the number one search term in the UAE, and I think
wow.
nearly in the world now. So I think people are really starting to prioritise their wellness, and so they kind of should be.
So in the retreat, let's say you had recently in the Alcazar retreat, the one that you'll be having in the Maldives in a month, what makes it so unique? What goes on these retreats?
Ah, absolutely. So for anyone who has been on a retreat before, maybe you've done a detox retreat or you've been on a yoga retreat, our retreats are quite different. We call them 360 transformative retreats, and that is kind of because we try and look at all the mental, physical, spiritual and emotional aspects equally.
Mm.
So we're not just going and focusing on the body and the breath, we're focusing on kind of the whole package. And our retreats are beyond yoga and those sorts of things. We have, as well as having yoga, we also have beautiful healthy meals, we have mindfulness and meditation, but at the same time we also have these really quite powerful and transformative workshops that happen.
Okay.
So we have hypnotherapy workshops, we have life coaching workshops, also sound healing and crystal healing, and integrated nutrition as well. So you really start to learn about the whole 360 wellness package rather than just focusing on the body. And then, as I mentioned before, with stress and anxiety being so high and people being feeling quite lonely and isolated, I think the long-term community element is also really important within our retreats, in that we really support people, we do one-to-one sessions with them, so we get to know them and really understand their individual issues and challenges that they're facing.
Mm.
And then beyond the retreat, we also run wellness mornings and days with our community members that bring them together and help them to feel supported and celebrated in all of their achievements since the retreat. And also, yeah, we do all of the one-to-one sessions as well. So we really like to keep that momentum and long-term relationships and support with our Beyond Wellness community.
Yeah, I was going to say, because if you had 40 people the other day in Alcazar, I can imagine, you know, it's a great way of building a new community, meeting new people and having that wellness journey all together, right?
Yeah, it's absolutely lovely. And I love it because we have various social groups of people on our social networks from our community, from the whole of the UAE and also across the world. And it's just amazing to see all of these people coming together and supporting each other on their kind of wellness journeys.
Healthy Habits
on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
So we're back with Rachel Dowes, who's the co-founder of Beyond Wellness, who creates retreats both here and abroad. Now, Rachel, let me ask you, I've been on a lot of yoga retreats in Italy and Europe and everything, and they've been great. But what I've noticed, not a lot of men go to them. What is the percentage when it comes to men and women at yours? And are you finding more men taking care of their health than going on these retreats?
This is such an interesting question. And if you'd asked me this question a couple of years ago, I would have said that the majority of people were women. But actually, very interestingly, the majority of people that are inquiring about our retreats now are actually men.
Wow.
And yeah, there seems to have definitely been a shift. And as we were mentioning earlier, you know, about this kind of awakening,
yes,
I think people are really starting to look inwards and looking at how they can incorporate wellness into their lifestyle and how they can feel better.
You know, it's funny because when we were growing up at school, you know, no one really talked about wellness. We just used to play on the streets and that used to keep us happy. But one thing my nephew was telling me now that at school is they do mindfulness and they have little meditation sessions. Are you finding a lot of younger people are getting into this kind of stuff?
Absolutely. And I think it's so important that they are at the moment. I mean, myself, I've got three children. I've got a young baby and I've got a toddler and I've also got a five-year-old. And I really have seen, you know, the amount of pressure on all of them, given the situation at the moment. You know, they miss their friends, they miss their families.
Yeah.
You know, they really, the homeschooling situation has been quite a challenging one. So absolutely. And from my clients, I've had a lot of people inquiring about, you know, doing mindfulness and kind of mindful yoga and these sorts of practices with their children, because, you know, it's the first time that the children have actually felt pressures like this, and it's really important to help them navigate those kind of internal, you know, feelings and emotions that they're having, and to try and help them feel supported.
Yeah, now, we go on these retreats. They could be, you know, a day, they could be a week, but how do we maintain them every day? What little small practices can you share with us or that you might do just to keep ourselves in check?
Absolutely. So for me, my practice is very much, I try and do as much mindfulness and meditation as I can each morning. Obviously, being a business owner, I'm quite connected to my phone a lot, but I try and make sure that each morning I will, before I even look at my phone, I will take some deep breaths and I'll kind of do a mindfulness meditation just in the present moment. Mm. And these sorts of practices are really good at just kind of setting you up for the day. I like to do affirmations as well and visualize how my day is going to be.
Yeah.
And I do tend to find that when I visualize a good day ahead, it tends to be a good day ahead. And the days when I don't, it's not so good.
So you're doing something with Jameera. Tell me about that.
Yeah, we're really excited. So we have a partnership with Jameera Group. And as I said, we've just had our last retreat last month at Alcazar, which was a really, really beautiful one on the waterways underneath the full moon for meditation. Really, really nice. And from September onwards, we're going to be having monthly retreats with Jameera, both here in the region and also at their global destination. So they've got lovely resorts in Bali, coming up Capri, etc. So we're really, really excited about that. And I think it'll be really nice for us to all get away and escape the heat.
Okay, so let's talk about the Maldives, which I'm so tempted to come to. What's that retreat? What's happening? What are the dates? How can people join?
Absolutely. So the Maldives is probably my most favourite retreat. It's a beautiful island called Villamendu Resort and Spa. It's absolutely stunning and has one of the most beautiful coral reefs in the Maldives. And so we'll be running this 5-day retreat from the 23rd of August until the 27th. And basically, it's an all-in package. Mm. You get your transfers on the seaplane, and then you have full-board accommodation, beautiful accommodation, some of it over water villas. It's really stunning. And you have detox healthy meals and juices every day. You'll have daily sunrise beach yoga, life coaching, hypnotherapy, sound healing, integrated nutrition, loads of workshops and one-to-ones, as well as daily meditation and mindfulness.
Yeah.
And they also have a really gorgeous spa which looks over the water. It's beautiful. We'll be having sound healing in there and massage treatment. So there's loads of pamper, but as well as the pamper, we've also got kind of the more transformative kind of soul-searching moments. And we always have lovely groups of people who come together and they end up kind of making friends and staying in touch. So I'm really, really looking forward to that one. We're also going to have dolphin spotting and island excursions and really enjoying the island, snorkeling and all of those sorts of things. Very exciting.
Okay.
A few places left.
You've sold it to me. Sign me up. So tell me, where can people sign up for this? Where can they follow Beyond Wellness for more of your treats as you do them each month?
Sure. So if they want to sign up for the Maldives or hear more about what we're up to, you can follow us on our Instagram page, which is beyondwellness.group. And if you want to see a little bit more about the programs that we have ahead, you can check out our website, which is www.beyondwellness-group.com.
Okay, Rachel, it has been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much. I know you're standing in the heat with your four-week-old baby, so I really appreciate that. And maybe we'll see you in the Maldives. Maybe I'll be there.
I really hope to welcome you sometime and the rest of your listeners. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Rachel.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Join the conversation
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Join Afternoons with Helen Farmer every weekday from 2 to 5 p.m.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.